Welcome to Onc Live On Air. I'm your host today, Ashling Wehner. In today's episode, we had the pleasure of speaking with Eunice Wang, MD, about the secondary AML treatment paradigm. In our exclusive interview, Dr. Wang discussed the prevalence of secondary AML and explained that this population lacks standard therapies, often relying on allogeneic stem cell transplantation. She noted that CPX351, a liposomal formulation of cytarabine and daunorubicin, has generated improved outcomes compared with 7+3 chemotherapy in this population. She also highlighted future research, which includes targeted therapies and less intensive regimens. What is the current standard of care for patients with secondary AML?
So secondary AML is an entity that we're going to see more of. It's making up about 25% of newly diagnosed AML cases, and it's defined as any acute myeloid leukemia that occurs after a preceding hematologic disorder like myelodysplastic syndrome or myeloproliferative neoplasm, or that has occurred in the setting of prior chemotherapy or radiation. Currently, there's no standard of care for these individuals, and treatment is largely based on whether patients are fit at the time of presentation and whether they are eligible for allogeneic stem cell transplantation. Overall prognosis of patients with secondary AML is much worse than patients with de novo AML, with higher rates of relapse, as well as only a very small percentage of these individuals passed with only about 10 or 15% living more than 3 years with standard chemotherapy. We now have some agents that have been used for treatment of these individuals, and one is not the standard cytarabine and daunorubicin for fit individuals, but a liposomal formulation of cytarabine and daunorubicin called CPX351 in a randomized phase 3 trial performed several years ago. Patients with secondary AML who were fit enough for intensive chemotherapy benefited from the use of CPX351 over standard 7+3, as reflected by improved overall the remission rates, as well as overall survival, in particular those patients who are able to go on to subsequent allogeneic stem cell transplantation.
Speaking about some real-world findings with CPX351, what was the rationale for conducting the V-Rules trial that analyzed the real-world outcomes of this agent in patients with secondary AML?
The rationale for performing this V-Rules retrospective analysis was based on the fact that although many prospective phase 3 trials have shown benefit for the use of various drugs for the treatment of acute myeloid leukemia in the real world, sometimes these randomized prospective studies are not reflective of what happens in actual clinical practice. So since the approval of this agent, the question was whether individual patients with secondary AML were really benefiting from this treatment. We also knew that there's a wide diversity of patients in biology that's encompassed with secondary AML, and there's an increased focus, for example, since the trial was initially performed, on looking at different mutational subsets of patients with secondary AML. So the hypothesis or the rationale was to perform this retrospective multi-center single arm study that really examined the medical records of adults with newly diagnosed therapy-related or secondary AML, defined as following prior MDS, who were treated over a couple years, 2023 to 2024, to look at safety, tolerability, outcome, and to do some subset analysis to determine which individual patients or characteristics of those patients that might have benefited or not benefited from this treatment.
What were some of the findings from this study that were presented at ASCO 2025, just in terms of efficacy here?
The primary objectives, really, of this study were to examine overall response rate, complete remission, MRD positive, negative rates, as well as overall survival. So we were able to collect records on 161 patients who had received at least one induction cycle of CPX351, with about a third of them, or 50 patients, receiving subsequent consolidation chemotherapy. It turned out that although the original phase 3 trial enrolled patients that were 60 and above, this retrospective analysis actually included younger patients. So the median age at AML diagnosis in this retrospective analysis was 60 years, with a range from 21 through 78 years. And what we found was that the median overall survival was about 12.9 months, and the four-year overall survival was 29%, both of which were improvements upon the data that we saw in the original phase 3 study, where patients treated with 7+3 on that study had a median overall survival of about 4 to 5 months, and patients treated with CPX on that study had a median overall survival of only 9 months. So our retrospective analysis did appear to improve upon even the results of our prior phase 3 study. Some differences might have been because those patients were 60 age and above, and we treated younger patients. Might have been improvements in standard of care or supportive care since then, but definitely it seemed to validate the positive findings from the prior prospective study. The median overall survival of younger patients was even greater than that. It was 17.8 months. And we think that potentially one reason for this improved survival was that a number of these patients may have been younger, been fitter, and had the option to go on to subsequent allogeneic stem cell transplantation. Your four-year overall survival of 29%, I think, also represents an improvement. In this study, about 38% of patients underwent allogeneic stem cell transplantation, and the median overall survival for those patients was a very impressive 45 months. So all of these outcomes of this analysis were positive and seemed to support the continued use of this agent in this particular patient population, and actually may have improved upon the original results. Patients that were treated on this trial that were treated in the outpatient setting, the initial phase 3 study required that patients getting this therapy be admitted to the hospital for the duration of their therapy. But one of the benefits of this drug is because of its liposomal formulation, it is not given as a continuous infusion, but it's actually given intermittently on days 1, 3, 5, and in consolidation on days 1 and 3. So in certain clinical settings, for certain patients, the therapy was able to be administered in the outpatient setting. For example, patients getting the drug on Monday, Wednesday, Friday, and maybe being admitted on Saturday, so saving them a week of hospitalization. And for subsequent, the 50 patients getting consolidation chemotherapy with drug only given at days 1 and 3, many patients were receiving that as well in the outpatient setting. What we were able to show is that administration of this drug in the ambulatory setting, which was not what happened at the original trial, was safe, and patients did well on this particular formulation. And these are issues that are increasingly important to our patients, of the ability to administer these outside of the hospital. Many still do recommend, or at least for induction, that patients do get admitted for a portion of that if they do experience a subsequent serious adverse event. About 42% of patients develop febrile neutropenia, so something definitely to watch out for with administration of this agent.
What are some challenges that remain regarding treatment optimization here?
Okay, so I think a couple of points. Number one, we know with our solid tumor colleagues and with the advent of therapies for oncological diseases across the board, that many of our patients are surviving longer, and we're going to likely see a rise in the number of patients that are developing secondary AML and secondary chemolignancies as side effects of potential cytotoxins. Number two, I think this long-term study, which had about 30, almost 40% of patients receiving allogeneic stem cell transplantation, just again emphasizes the importance of patients with this diagnosis not only getting upfront therapy, but getting an allogeneic stem cell transplantation for the curative intent. And as we mentioned, those patients lived a median of over almost 4 years after this diagnosis. Third, I think the challenge of patients with AML, as we talked about with the rising incidence and the overall aging of the general population, is that we're increasingly seeing patients in their older decades developing secondary AML. So we are actively working on development of less toxic regimens, maybe with a less intensive chemotherapy background, for example, with the venetoclax or hypomethylating therapy backbone, and seeing whether they can fare as well as the younger patients do with CPX in terms of tolerability and being able to get them to an allogeneic stem cell transplantation. So we've had some developments in allogeneic stem cell transplantation with the development of safer, less toxic allogeneic stem cell transplants, better management of graft versus host disease that has permitted more of our older and or unfit patients to get transplanted and allowing us to perform transplant in patients for whom we previously did not have a donor. So I think that that's very promising. For patients that have therapy-related AML, there may be a certain percentage of patients that have specific genetic aberrations. For example, many of our younger female patients who have received anthracycline-based chemotherapy for their cancers, whether it be ovarian and or breast cancer, have secondary or therapy-related AMLs with a translocation in the KMT2A gene. For those patients, we've seen the advent of a novel targeted therapy make its way to FDA approval, these class of agents called menin inhibitors. One menin inhibitor, revumenib, has already been approved for patients with renal cell refractory acute leukemias characterized by that specific KMT2 rearrangements. And we are starting to see at least three or four other menin inhibitors making their way towards possible FDA approval as well. So for patients with KMT2 rearranged leukemias, they may be eligible for additional therapy with these menin inhibitors in combination with intensive and less intensive chemotherapy such as CPX and or Bev-Aza moving forward.
That's all we have for today. Thank you for listening to this episode of OncLive On Air. Check back throughout the week for exclusive interviews with leading experts in the oncology field. For more updates in oncology, be sure to visit onclive.com and sign up for our e-newsletters. OncLive is also on social media. On X and Blue Sky, follow us at OncLive. On Facebook, like us at OncLive, and follow our OncLive page on LinkedIn. If you liked today's episode of OncLive On Air, please consider subscribing to our podcast on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, and many of your other favorite podcast platforms so you get a notification every time a new episode is posted. While you're there, please take a moment to rate us. Thanks again for listening to OncLive On Air.